Welcome to Wise Talk. So the first thing I want to do is welcome you, Yvonne. Thank you so much for being with us today and taking time out of your busy CEO schedule. So appreciate it. Let me just talk a little bit about Yvonne a second, and then we'll get into the questions. So Yvonne Wassenaar is the CEO of Puppet. It's a trusted enterprise provider of IT automation software across traditional and cloud native environments. She is a seasoned C-level executive with broad experience scaling companies globally and driving enterprise transformation with technology throughout the Americas, Europe, and Asia. Prior to Puppet, Yvonne served as CEO of Airware, CIO at New Relic, and held multiple leadership roles at VMware and Accenture. She is currently a board member of Forrester, Anaplan, and Harvey Mudd College. I assume you went to Harvey Mudd?
I did not. I went to UCLA.
Okay. All right. I went to Oxy, so that's why I thought I was curious about Harvey Mudd. Amidst growing concerns with how modern technology could be used, Yvonne has championed it to drive a safer, more efficient, and innovative planet. So we're going to talk about that a little bit too. Yvonne holds a BA in economics and with a specialization in computing and an MBA in strategy and operations from the university's UCLA's Anderson School of Business. Her market impact earned her recognition as a woman of influence in Silicon Valley, the board list top 20, San Francisco Business Times Public Company CIO Award winner, and as a Wall Street Journal Women of Note. You can certainly look up her website, puppet.com, and her Twitter is at ytechdata. That's just the letter Y, tech data. So again, welcome. Really happy that you're with us. Turns out Yvonne and I are actually about 10 minutes away from each other. So I'm in the Twin Peaks area of San Francisco and Yvonne is in Sunset. So I often start, we've been doing these calls for 15 years. And so I always start with the first question, which is that, you know, tell us a little bit about your journey. I read your bio, it's your official bio, but tell us how you started in tech and then how you came to be the CEO of Puppet. Just give us a little bit of a story that's not necessarily your bio.
Yeah, the story behind the story. I'm glad that you do that, because what's often interesting to me is most people assume that I had a master plan and I've executed it brilliantly. And it's interesting, if I look back, I can tell a great story of how I, you know, systematically plan to go from one stop to the next. And I think, similar to so many of us, it's been a really curvy journey. Mm-hmm. And I owe a tremendous amount to the mentors and sponsors that I've had along the way. And I'd start with a shout out to all the teachers and professors out there. When I went to college in the early 80s, I didn't know what a computer was. I didn't know what computer programming was. I didn't know what tech was. I thought I was going to be a business economist. Mm. And my calculus professor, Professor Radcliffe, said, "Hey, you want to take my Pascal class?" And I was like, "What's that?" He's like, "Oh, you know, it's programming language. I think you'd be really good at it." And I fell in love with writing code. Mm-hmm. And I learned assembler and Fortran, and it put me on a whole different career trajectory than I would have ever expected.
Cool.
So I started at Accenture as a software engineer, coding when COBOL was cool. I'm now infinitely employable, as everybody of that genre retires, and there's still mainframes out there. But what's interesting is, you know, I'd kind of divide my career up into chapters. Accenture was a great place to go. I went back to business school after being a little disheartened about waterfall programming. Mm-hmm. And spending a lot of time typing up somebody else's structured charts and waiting for big conversions over long weekends. And I think the agile methodologies we have now are so much more fulfilling to people doing the work, as well as better for the folks that they're in service to. Mm-hmm. So I chose to go to business school, but I did go back to Accenture, and I ended up being a strategy consultant in the tech sector. And I was there for 17 years. And I easily could have been there for my entire career. Many of my colleagues and peers are still there. But I had an executive coach, and I'd been a partner for several years. And she asked me, she goes, "Well, what do you want to do next?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, maybe a double promotion." She said, "Well, do you want to be a consultant forever? And it was funny. Like, it was like this visceral reaction, like, God, no, of course not. And she's like, I hate to break it to you, but you know, if you don't do something different soon, it's going to be really hard. Cause it's all I had done since I had left college was be a consultant of some type. Mm-hmm. And I was really nervous. My fiance of many years had passed away of cancer. I had chosen to have kids through IVF. I have three children. So here I was, a single mom with a three-year-old and one-year-old twins, and somebody's telling me I should go change my job.
Wow, that's intense.
Yeah, I was somewhat freaked out. And ultimately what she convinced me, and she was absolutely right, is it wasn't as risky a move as I perceived it. And so I went to go work for a client of mine, VMware. They'd been my client for several years. And what was interesting is what she told me that kind of pushed me over the edge was, you can always go back. You've been doing it for 17 years. You've been wildly mm-hmm. successful. You can mm-hmm. always go back, but you can't always go forward unless mm-hmm. you make a change. And so mm-hmm. I went, you know, obviously some of that was relatively safe. I knew my boss. I knew the executives. By going somewhere that was trusted, I was able to make the transition into an operating role, which mm-hmm. is very different than a consulting role. And yet again, my age came into play because I got this inkling I wanted to do board work. And I was talking to a friend of mine who connected me with her husband. And he said, Yvonne, you're one of the smartest people I know, so don't take this the wrong way, but I'd never put you on one of my boards. I was like, Tim, why would you say that? And he's like, you know nothing about raising money. You know nothing about venture capital. He goes, all you've ever done, he's like, smallest company you've ever worked for is VMware. And that's massive in my world. Sure. So what help would you be to me in a boardroom? And it really made me start thinking about, well, how do I get that experience? And he said, well, I hate to break it to you, but you're closer to 50 than you think. And I was in my mid 40s at the time. But he said, you know, there is age discrimination, and you need to think about if you're going to work somewhere smaller, you have to prove that you can make that transition. And so that's what prompted me to go to New Relic. I did get on the board of a startup called Bitium that we ended up selling to Google. I subsequently got on the board of Forrester and MuleSoft. We sold MuleSoft to Salesforce. I was able to do that. But it really gave me, again, that confidence of what's the worst that could happen. Mm-hmm. I can always go back to a big company. Right. And so for me, that was a really freeing experience to recognize that repeatability of risk-taking not being as risky as I perceived it, and opening up new opportunities. So for me, it was very similar. I interviewed for the board seat at Airware, didn't take it because they gave it to John Chambers from Cisco. And then they asked me if I wanted.
Oh, well.
I know. I was like, oh, well.
Hey, now they would. Yeah, you know, because they're required to have one woman on every board.
Yeah, but the good thing that came out of it was I didn't leave New Relic at the time, but a year later, after John was on the board, he came and asked if I would help come scale the company. And took him 4.5 months to talk me into it, but it was a great opportunity. And I went over as COO, and two weeks into it, they asked me to be CEO. And again, I was really nervous. I said, I gave John 1,000 reasons why it was a bad idea. And he just said, stop, because just tell me, what's your vision for the company? How would you get there? What would you do? And mm-hmm. he ultimately said, you know, hey, you're more ready for this than you think. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be your co-pilot. And I tell that story because I think, you know, people look at resumes and like, wow, you know, that person had it all figured out. Or, you know, they were ready to take risks that maybe I'm not ready for. And I think a huge part of being able to have an interesting and fulfilling career comes from surrounding yourself with people who will push you when right. you need that push, or they'll pull you when mm-hmm. you need a hand up. And I think that's probably the thing that I appreciate most, and I now try to do for others.
Cool. Well, thank you for telling us those stories. It's cool. Especially the John Chambers story. That's awesome. I want to talk a little bit about COVID particularly, and the challenges that you're facing. And, you know, this whole year we're talking about stress. We actually picked the subject way before we knew about COVID, because we picked it in December of last year. obviously apropos. So I want you to tell us a, like your biggest challenge business-wise and also your biggest challenge personally.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is the biggest business challenge I think companies face right now is very dependent on what type of business you're in. Mm-hmm. And for us, Puppet benefits from the fact that we're a software company and we serve the Global 5000. Our software helps people run things remotely. So for us, the business transition was not the hard business challenge. Mm-hmm. I'd say the hard business challenge has been the repetitive stress that we have been facing as human beings trying to get work done. And that's everything from, you know, the pandemic. The hardest thing with the pandemic and the work from home was when the schools closed. We have a lot of parents who have kids between 1 and 10, which is the, how do you teach a child to write in a Zoom? You can't just put a five-year-old and say, hey, watch somebody write and do that. So I think, you know, there's that, there's been the fires, there's been the protests, there's been Brexit. I've got a big office in Belfast. And so there's a lot of stress around that. There've been the fires, there's been, you know, election
more fires,
election challenges around the globe. So there's just been like, every time people think that, okay, I can deal with this now, something mm-hmm. else happens. Mm-hmm. And for us from a business perspective, that's what we're trying to take care of our people for. I mean, on one hand, because our business is going well and what we do is in service to people navigating the pandemic and beyond, people do get that escape going to work. But we've had to be really thoughtful around mental health. Mm-hmm. We've done a couple special company holidays. We've chosen to do them on Mondays because isn't that great to not have to work on a Monday? Mm-hmm. And to do them globally, we have done a lot around flexible work hours. We've just really tried to find ways to help our teams connect and decompress and realize that it's all okay. Personally, for me,
what's been your personal challenge?
Yeah, I'd say personally for me, you know, I have three kids. I have a sophomore in high school. I've got twins that are in seventh grade now, and you know, I've been a virtual CEO, so that part's not hard. And my kids are doing pretty well in school. They're old enough; they can they're responsible, which is great. I feel blessed, but it's. I'd say that for me, it's figuring out where I draw the line in this challenging time from my own personal beliefs mm-hmm. to what I say and represent as the CEO of Puppet. And I think that has been most challenging for me personally as it deals with the systemic racism mm-hmm. and the, you know, challenges and just different perspectives going on around the election and really trying to help my team understands, you know, we're not a political institution. We're not a nonprofit. We're a business in service of our customers and communities, but right. we do have core values. Right. And so for me, I've probably spent the most personal time really trying to get grounded in what are my own values and how do they relate to, but how are they different from the abstraction you have to make when you're representing an entire global company, but doing it with integrity that you can sleep well at night and be proud and be true to the values that the company was founded on and attract the people there to begin with.
So is the challenge there, I'm gonna push you, not push you, but delve a little bit further on that. Is the challenge there personally that you're not sure how far you wanna go with your own personal beliefs, especially if they're political?
Yeah, well, I'll give you an example. So, and some of this is, I think the pandemic has made us all much more insular. So we hear the news on our own TV, we're hypersensitive to what's going on in our world. Mm-hmm. I run a global company. So when Ruth Bader Ginsburg, well, if I take a step back, when George Floyd was killed and there was a social unrest associated with that, we took a company stand to say that we stand with the Black community. We put a banner on our website and we wrote a series of posts and we've been taking a whole series of actions around what that means from a company standpoint. From a policy standpoint, we wrote letters to different government officials, both state and federal, around supporting regulation to curb police violence and those types of things. And there was some pushback of, well, why are you doing it? You know, that's not the right answer. The right answer is to disband police forces. Another thing that came up was when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, somebody asked, well, can you put a banner? Can we put a banner on the website saying, you know, a hero has fallen? And my response to that was like, while I'm personally devastated, she's been a role model for me my entire life. Where do I draw the line? If I do that for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I didn't do that for John Lewis. I didn't do that for, you know, some international folks who've died. How do you, like, how do you operationalize that? And so I think those are the things where you can feel personally attached to something and you have to take a step back and say, okay, but I represent a global community that has different perspectives. And quite frankly, you know, I'm in business of delivering infrastructure software to companies that run some of the most critical businesses around the world. Like, that's what I have to keep my focus on, but I have to do it with empathy and transparency and humanity.
Right. I'm feeling you for sure on that. So let's talk about culture. You mentioned you know, again, in your last answer, you're talking about mental health of your employees. And of course, our work at Mariposa is a lot about, we do executive coaching. A lot of what we're hearing is a lot about culture. So we're helping people focus on that, especially trying to develop the virtual water cooler. I know, kind of tough to do, right?
Yeah.
So tell, what are you doing for that? Like, how are you keeping in touch with folks, and how are you making sure that their mental health is in the front?
Yeah, there's a whole host of things. Yeah, I think some of them are pretty standard in the sense that, you know, people have done virtual happy hours. We do more Slack chats, things like that. So if I try to call out some of the things that I think are a little bit more kind of unique and interesting that we've done. One is we ran a 8-week resiliency training course for 26 of our top leaders.
Yes.
So we did resiliency training, which was every other week, 26 of us would get together for 2 hours. We'd, you know, learn some techniques around limiting beliefs and, you know, kind of the power of positive thinking and just different elements. And then we'd be in breakout groups and we could really share stories with each other. And there were podcasts and articles and books we could read in between, and we had homework in between. And the most brilliant thing about it was the fact that we were able to connect these leaders from around the globe. And because of the nature of the homework assignments, they became very personal conversations around what is my purpose? Why am I showing up at work every day? You know, what are my limiting beliefs? And it created a level of connectivity in the company that still continues on today. We also learned some good techniques we could leverage with our own teams to help them kind of see the silver lining on some of the challenges that we're facing. But it was a good reminder that what's hard in the virtual world is being vulnerable, is being able to really connect at that different level. And so that's one thing that we did, I think, that was very powerful. And
so resiliency training, that's awesome. It's great.
Yeah, and the key was making it over a period of time. So it was doses and giving people homework and putting them in small breakout rooms in Zoom where they could get really personal instead of being able to hide in a group of 26.
Right.
So that was really good. Personally, I probably sent out about 50 different care packages over the course of the first 3 months with handwritten notes and silly drawing books and just something to express appreciation for what people were going through. I mean, we had folks who had family members who were sick or passed away and they couldn't travel, and just, you know, demonstrating that, you know, there's at least a physical touch if it's not a human touch. So we did that. I would say the folks who live in areas that have more people, they would do corner happy hours where they'd stand on different corners. And, yeah.
And you kind are of, doing that. Good.
Yeah. So we did all that. And then on the work front, what we did is we acknowledged early on that we weren't going back to the offices soon. And so we did two things. One is we created transparency so people would have visibility to what would have to be true before we'd go back to offices. Mm-hmm. And so we have a Confluence page that, you know, shows people those metrics. So it's not a guessing game. They don't have to get inside my head. They can say, okay, you know, what are the infection rates? What are, you know, these different measures? And we also gave them a stipend to make their work environment at home more accommodating. We let them, people who are close to offices, take furniture home. So we've done a bunch of things to try to help. And then we've always had support for mental health and for and groups to come together to talk about things that are challenging. So a bunch of different things.
Yeah, exactly. How did you decide at the beginning to, and even now, deciding to say, hey, we're not, you know, we're going to be remote first, work from anywhere in whatever, however you're languaging it. How did you decide? Because a lot of companies didn't do that. They were sort of like, okay, it's going to be a month, and it's going to be 2 months, now it's going to be 6 months, and you know. So what was going through? You mentioned the infection rates, but how else did you decide? What other criteria did you use to decide that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. One of the things that I've learned throughout my career is that a lot of what drives stress is uncertainty and when we feel powerless. Yes. And so my belief is that as a leader, your most important job beyond taking care of yourself, and some of us need to be reminded it's important to take care of yourself and ask for help and do all those things, but your most important job beyond that is to provide calm, to provide perspective, and to give people a sense of certainty and knowing. Even if that knowing is not what they would prefer, the mere fact that they know something makes them feel empowered and helps them guide their own path forward. So for us, the three kind of chunks of time I look at, in the decision to close our offices globally, the turning point for me was one of my peers shared with me a medical document that helped me understand that it wasn't a question of were my employees safe. It was a question of were we further propagating the spread of the virus. And so we moved to work from home on the earlier side in March because we had the ability to easily do so. We were a software company, and we realized beyond just looking at the safety of our own team, we had an obligation to contribute to the safety and health of the communities that we lived and worked in.
Right.
So that kind of guided that decision. The next chunk was, you know, were we going to be able to go back anytime soon? And what I concluded was that I started notice that without putting a date out there, people were really anxious because they were just trying to power through. Mm-hmm. So I believe it was in the May timeframe, I put a stake in the ground and I said that we wouldn't be going back to offices until at least October. And that's when we did the office stipend and just said, hey, it sucks, but we all have to figure out how to make it work because it is what it is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We then were able to come up with what were the kind of standard metrics that we could use and report on reliably that have to do with, you know, what are the, you know, city, state, you know, country regulations, what are the infection rates, what is the ability for us to open our offices? If we do open them, how will we let people in? And so we provided all that certainty. And I would say a couple months ago, in June, I think it was the end of June, what we told folks is that looking at the data that we had, it would be, it wouldn't be until the first half of 2021 until we opened up our London or our Portland office, and that we were trying to see if there were opportunities to open some of the other offices, at least for a period of time before then. We have not been able to do that yet. But we have tried to put the markers out there and just help people understand, like, it's, we all want to wish it away, but since it's not going away, let's learn how to adapt, because then it just takes that stress away. I don't have to, I can plan for what I need to do with my kids and my home care and,
right,
you know, all these other things.
Right, right. That's awesome. Okay. So we talked about culture and about stress, mental health, culture. But I'm wondering about strategy. I'm wondering about how you see Puppet pivoting, no, how you've been able to pivot. It's probably, we probably can make some alliteration there, Puppet pivoting. It's hard to say. pivoting Puppet. How you pivoted and how you see as a CEO, how important that is to design that. And then also how you see other, what advice do you have for other companies in terms of pivoting? But obviously we've been talking a lot about like, you have to pivot something. Like it's gonna be, we don't know what, but it's gonna be something. At least it's the communication or the culture, it's at least that, but it's probably a lot of other things too in terms of strategy. So talk to us a little bit about that and then I'm gonna open it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And when, so back in March when this all started happening, you know, to that mindset that I've learned over my career, which is you need to create perspective and calm and figure out what you can control. I think I benefited from the fact that I was an ex-strategy consultant and I still dream in charts and scenarios. And so we did two different types of scenario analysis really to give us the playbooks we would need to be able to be transparent with our teams and move quickly. Because oftentimes what happens, and we saw this in spades, is people who were freaking out just couldn't make any decisions at all.
Yeah.
And the world was kind of just moving around them. But for people who could kind of find that calm and see a path forward, they could move towards something.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to figure out what we could move towards. So on the, what I call the world scenario front, we came up with four different scenarios, kind of a gradual recovery, you know, fits and starts where, you know, there's second and third waves and it's, you know, in the office, out of the office, in the office, out of the office. The perfect storm, which is everything goes to hell in a handbasket and there's a depression and the virus is, you know, hard to contain and all these other things. And the great correction, which is, wow, we all learn new ways of being and connecting and they're fabulous and we'll never go back to the way it was. And we're excited about that. And what I told the team is none of these are true. There's going to be little elements of all of them that are true. Yeah. But if we could take them in their pure form and say, what would that mean for Pivot? Or what would that mean for Puppet if that was our true future?
Mm-hmm.
There's two really interesting things that happen. The first is you start to realize some actions you could take are good in all four scenarios. So why wait? Mm-hmm. And that gave us what we call our no regret moves, which was really satisfying. Because we're like, wow, we can do this. And in all scenarios, it's going to be great. Isn't that wonderful? The second thing is it gave us a playbook to understand what to look for and what might change. So for example, marketing events, you know, or, you know, where we're working from, or what type of products are going to be most relevant, or what type of marketing messages. And so we also identified what was different. And what were the indicators we'd look at? And I'd say the world scenarios gave us control of really kind of our product roadmap, our brand messaging, and how we engaged with each other and with the world. Mm-hmm. The second thing we did was financial scenarios.
Yeah.
As we said, regardless of what happens in the world, there's different ways that this might impact us from a top line perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would we do? And so we created a revised plan, and then we did two upside scenarios and two downside scenarios. Somebody asked me the other day, like, how did you decide what the right steps were? And I said, well, you know, downside scenario two is you're selling the company. Mm-hmm. Downside scenario one is you're making more cuts. You know, upside scenario one is you're making some really meaningful incremental investments. And upside two is you're probably buying stuff. So that's my rough rule of thumb. And then we just went through and said, okay, what makes the most sense? And again, we had a playbook. And so we, at the end of March, we did pull forward some business decisions to become more intimate with our customers, to change our go-to-market model underneath our new customer, chief revenue officer. We pivoted a bit on our product roadmap to pull forward things like development and patch management and some of our task-based automation that we thought would be more critical during the pandemic. And so we made some product shifts. And you know, as a result of that, we did let a meaningful number of people go. which was super, super hard. But we were very transparent with the company. Everybody pulled together and worked really hard to find the people we had to let go jobs. And we were very successful in that. And I think that's one of the hardest things is to reach out to people who've been let go, but the community really came together. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we massively changed our financial profile and our ability to control our own future, regardless of how long the pandemic would go on. And so, you know, we became, you know, free cash flow positive, we became adjusted EBITDA positive. And as life has it, we performed better on the top line than we thought. So we're like, okay, we're trending towards upside one. Well, we know what to do. That means we have more money to spend. We know what we want to spend it on. Mm-hmm. And so we've been able to make much faster business decisions. And what's interesting is people who struggled with some of the hard decisions we made early on have subsequently come back and said, first off, the transparency has been great because mm-hmm. I feel I know, and knowing is really important in stressful, uncertain times. And I now see why you made those decisions. Mm-hmm. Nobody has a crystal ball. We might have to make more hard decisions going forward, but I now understand how it plays out. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I would love to go into like how do you decide on those four scenarios and such, but let's let people talk here. So does anybody want to ask a question? We have one question here. I'm curious if survivor's guilt showed up in post layoff.
How you handled it. Yeah, I mean, people ask me, you know, what's the hardest thing you've ever had to do at work? And the hardest decision you ever make is to let people go.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how many times you do it, it never gets any easier. Mm-hmm. But what I do think is you learn the skills that make it productive. And what I mean by that is being really thoughtful and not kind of backing yourself in a corner and having to be really reactionary, but being very planful, being very transparent with both the people staying and leaving on why hard decisions are being made. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, coming together as a community after to help each other out. It's not somebody's fault when they get laid off. You know, they're not a bad person. It's not that they're not doing a great job. It's that things have shifted. And so for me, I personally reached out to a large number of people who were let go, and I offered my network. I wrote letters of recommendation. I made introductions. Mm-hmm. And many people within Puppet did that. And so I think the first thing on the survivor guilt is by taking those actions, I think it's harder when you're one of the people who made the decision because you do feel guiltier about having caused the pain. Mm-hmm. But for everybody, I think it's tough. But the first thing it does by helping those who've been let go is it allows you to take action in a positive way. The second thing that I'd say is as we've navigated through the pandemic, what I was really clear about is we were making these hard choices so that we could take care of the company that remained and really do the right thing for our customers. So doing things like being able to give a home office stipend to people who were sitting on horrible chairs that were breaking their back or you know, whatever the issue was, that was meaningful. And, you know, seeing what we've been able to do and invest and drive success. And quite frankly, we have two companies that used to play in our space that both have been acquired in the last month. And so seeing the health of our company relative to others, I think helps people understand why we made the hard choices. I think it makes it any easier, but it does help with, you know, some of the emotion that comes along with making those hard choices.
Well, just in terms of your own person, I mean, this one I've noticed in how far we've been together, your personality has, you definitely have a combination of warmth and practicality. So that I'm sure it made it easier for them. And you obviously are doing empathy, and the fact that you reach out personally to people is pretty amazing. So it sounds like it went as well as it can go, and it's not easy. Thank you, Laura, for that question. Ramon's asking, can you walk through, it's actually the four pandemic planning scenarios again. Gradual recovery, fits and starts, perfect storm, and the great correction. So if you wanna just go through those quickly again, gradual recovery, everybody, fits and starts, perfect storm, and great correction.
Yeah, a couple of things that might be helpful on these. What we went through is we defined what each one looked like, and it's a combination of, and it's kind of bizarre in retrospect because things have not all moved in alignment, but things like how are stock markets performing? How are different industry segments performing? What is the unemployment rate? Right. What are venture capitalists investing in? Mm-hmm. What's on the cover of the magazines that our customers read, the virtual magazines? And so we have a collection of metrics that help us understand what are the trends from technology adoption, mm-hmm. what's the state of different economies. And again, being a global company, it's a bit different. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing we did to help understand the different areas. And then for each of those, once we defined what those kind of metrics look like, we went through and defined, okay, what does this mean for our product strategy? What products are most relevant? What does it mean for buyer values? So for example, in, the Great Depression, it's like, well, people probably want cost cutting and optimization. Mm-hmm. In the Brave New World, in the Perfect Storm, they want cost cutting and optimization. In the Great Correction, they want more cloud native, they want more innovation. And so we went through and said, product, marketing messages, how people are engaging, what type of acquisitions we might do, who we might talk to, what things we might want to be saying. We went through and defined all of those. And that gave us a really robust playbook. And we do have, for anybody who wants, somewhere on the puppet.com website, we actually open sourced a worksheet that kind of walks people through the process we went through. So if anybody wants to try it on their own, it's a great exercise to kind of gain control in an uncertain environment.
Yeah, I remember March 1st, I was, trying to buy things ahead of the game. And I remember March 16th, how, I remember it vividly because I remember exactly where I was, how, I certainly didn't think the stock market would do what it was going to do. I was scared for sure. But I also felt like there were certain tech companies that would do really well in the situation, obviously cloud being one of them, because we were going to have to rely on it, right?
Yeah.
But I remember that feeling. Do you remember that feeling when that time period? Do you remember? It seems like in retrospect now, practically like here are the four scenarios, but I'm curious how your emotional, how you felt emotionally and how that played into it and how you kept yourself sort of grounded. I mean, I felt I had to continue to hold grief and possibility at the same time and just try to balance it because it wasn't easy. It still isn't easy, but it's still a little easier now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, if I go back to my personal story, my fiance passed away when I was 36, mm-hmm. and he'd been perfectly healthy, mm-hmm. went in for surgery to fix a deviated septum, and they found a B-cell lymphoma, which was supposed to be very treatable. And so he went to a sperm bank because he was going to have to go through chemo, and that might cause infertility implications. And then 4 months into outpatient chemo, he was diagnosed with a very rare and aggressive T-cell lymphoma. Mm. And he passed away 2 months after that. We did a bunch of experimental treatment, this, that, and the other. But the two things that were really amazing out of that, one was when we left the hospital, we tried this experimental treatment. They did the bone marrow biopsy. His bone marrow was still cancerous. The oncologist, who was the sweetest woman on the planet, I still remember, just blonde hair, bright smiling face, just a lovely human being. I don't know how she did her job, but she had me in her office and she said, I just want you to know, it was a Friday morning. She said, he might not survive the weekend. And so she handed me the sheet of paper and she pointed to this number on the bottom. She goes, here's the number you call if he passes away. And I was 36 and I just remember, like, even though he'd been sick for a really long time, like the concept of him dying, let alone dying with just me there, was this shock to the system. And the two things that happened that changed me deeply, one was he lived for another several weeks. And the oncologists can't tell anybody how that medically was possible because over 50% of his bone marrow was cancerous. But I know that he lived that long because he had things to do. He had brothers he wanted to talk to who didn't live in the US. He wanted to make sure I was okay. And so it made me realize we all have things inside us that can fuel us through times that we need. And that's the other part of it. Like I made it through that. Mm-hmm. And then you realize when things matter and you have purpose, you can find that resilience and you can find that strength. And so I think for me, well, at one level, I'm like, my gosh, the sky is falling.
Yeah, I mean,
I really went back to that, mm-hmm. that responsibility mm-hmm. and purpose that, you know, as the CEO,
yeah.
you know, your job is to take care
yeah.
of the company, and the company is the people. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was really that, quite frankly, that kind of put me into operation mode, which is all right. How do I de-stress myself? I need to figure out what I can effectively do. And so that, to me, I mean, I remember it was like, oh my gosh, the stock market. I mean, like I was convinced we were going to be in the perfect storm, mm-hmm. but I'm like, you never know. And that's where, you know, I'm constantly reminded, like, you're not as smart as you think you are. Having different plans and having different perspectives is important. And the other thing I'll say is I've spent a lot of time talking to Black leaders over the last handful of months. And one time I was just really kind of down in the dumps around all the stuff that happened. And this woman who is an amazing Black leader just looked at me and she's like, stop. She goes, yeah, there's a lot of shitty stuff, excuse my language, happening. But your job is to focus on what you can control and what you can do. And if we all do that, we'll move the needle.
Right.
So get out of your pity party. And so I think like that's where we can help each other out and where community is so important and having those mentors and sponsors and really caretakers is critical.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, in that moment, she pulled you out in terms of she used a pity party. But at the same time, I think that there is reasons for those of us who are CEO, I mean, all of us, there are reasons for those of us who are trying to lead our company. You're a CEO, I'm a CEO. It's okay if we're sad, you know, it's okay if we're having a hard day. And, but at some point, I mean, you do have to pull yourself out and find ways, but and get the support that you need to be able to do that. And as a concept that I've been using with my clients and also with other coaches, the idea of comparative suffering and how if we compare ourselves to a myriad of people, especially frontline workers, especially people of color who are experiencing more stress than normal, whatever that means, you know, it's like, well, you know, it's okay. Like we have a pretty good situation we're in. However, it's agreeable. It's just that there's also a lot of sadness because we aren't going to have the life we had. And there is grief that goes with that. And so it's okay to feel that. So I've been trying to like sort of balance that, right? It's like, you know, don't go down the rat hole, but at the same time, it's okay to feel some sadness
yeah.
and some grief. My last question has to do with this. So you call it, what do you call it? The Great Correction. I'm calling it the new, I probably more the next normal, because I think we're in a new normal now, and there's going to be a next normal. And I don't think it becomes next normal once we have a vaccine. I don't think that's the way it's going to work. I think that it's going to be very gradual, actually. Vaccine, treatment, testing, all those together would be helpful. So how do you see this playing out? Like, what does a Great Correction mean to you as far as the things we've learned that we can actually do better in the after?
I tend to be a glass half full person, mm-hmm. and look for those things. Mm-hmm. It's to me what I'm super excited about. One is I believe there's a lot of goodness in technology. I think it can be bad and it can be used in bad ways, but I think fundamentally we can use it to the betterment of society. And I think a lot of key digitization trends that are accelerating, I think, are going to be really powerful. So for example, my family and I have done, you know, multiple doctor's visits virtually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my kids are doing school virtually. And we just had our Harvey Mudd board meeting and the whole college is virtual. And while I don't think it will stay 100% virtual, I think there are some things around accessibility, around different learning mechanisms, around affordability in both, you know, healthcare and education that are super exciting mm-hmm. now that we're forced to accelerate them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really
school being for sure one of them.
Yeah. Another one is I do think for all the pain that we're experiencing right now around kind of the social injustice and systemic racism, I think a lot of really important questions that have been easy to brush to the side around economic disparity and racial disparity are coming to the forefront. And, you know, I'll say my 14-year-old, my 12-year-olds are much more educated and informed mm-hmm. and taking action. And so I think that's a long road, mm-hmm. But you have to start. And so I feel that there's a greater contingent and a stronger dialogue than we've had in the past. That'll be really positive. So I think on the macro scale, those things are really big and important. On the micro scale, I do think remote work is here to stay, or what I call hybrid remote. Yeah. I think that's great for equality. It makes it a lot easier if you have a family mm-hmm. Or other constraints. You're a caregiver. You can still, you don't have to be in an office 9 to 5. And that opens up opportunities for people to get more engaged. Mm-hmm. I think security is going to increasingly be a topic we need to look at and understand. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot that we'll...
You're talking about cybersecurity.
Yeah, cybersecurity. Because we do more remote, more becomes digitized. Sure. I'm an ex-CIO. Those things, you know, make me nervous. But I think those are sure. things that there's a new set of problems that we'll have to solve. But they're in service to some really good and powerful shifts in how we live and work.
Great. Thank you. Just want to remind everyone that you can go onto puppet.com, and it sounds like there's some things that you can look at regarding these scenarios, which is awesome. Thank you for making that transparent. I think it's going to be helpful to a lot of others. So again, my heart goes out to you and to everybody on this call. So Yvonne, again, thank you so much. I just wanted to talk about next time we're together on October 19th at 2 p.m. Pacific with Michael Solomon, who is founder of 10X Management and the co-author of Game Changer, How to Be 10X in the Talent Economy. So we'll be talking with him about that. Appreciate it. Thanks again, Yvonne, for being with us. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say if people are interested in the scenario planning, if you go to puppet.com and just search for scenario planning, you'll find the open source toolbook. We did the work in association with Trium, and they have some great articles on the whole concept as well. So thank you for the opportunity. Like I said, I love your podcast series, and it's a real honor to have been able to join you.
Well, it's an honor for you to come and join us. So thank you. Take care and stay safe.